And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome. Yes, it's that time again. Time to explore and defend the faith. And you're listening to Hands-On Apologetics, Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I am Gary Matuta. And as you heard, the Virgin Most Powerful Apologetics Dojo is now open for service. I am your good friend and host and also, I guess, part-time sensei. Because as you know on this show, we often have guests step in. They take over the sensei part. I just kind of ask the questions and make them look good, I guess. That's my role. So today we do have a guest, and it's a longtime friend, convert, and someone who you may be familiar with. He's been on a number of shows. Rob Corzine is going to come into the dojo and talk to us about an area of history that I believe is probably one of the most distorted and misunderstood parts of history. It's a common canard that is thrown at the Catholic Church, and really, you know, there's a huge disparity between what people think this thing is and what it actually is. What is it? Wait for it, as Dr. Maza sometimes says. Wait for it. It's the Spanish Inquisition. Ah, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. Well, yes, today that's going to be our topic, and Rob Corzine is going to help us break it down and talk about the black legend of the Spanish Inquisition and sort out fact from fiction, what exactly it was, and also, you know, answer some other questions too, like is it possible that we could ever end up with another Inquisition, things like that. So that's going to be a lot of fun. He's going to be coming up on the other side of the first break, and we're going to dive into that material. And also we're going to do our usual segments, Finding the Fallacy. As always, we always try to go through certain fallacious ways of arguments, try to sharpen our critical thinking skills so that we can identify when somebody perhaps gives an argument that's not very sound in its reasoning. And today's fallacy is called the quantitative fallacy. It's also known as the McNamara fallacy. And the Meet the Early Church Father that we're going to meet is a very unusual church father. The name is Ambrosiaster, and what's unusual about him is that there's no such person as Ambrosiaster. So we'll talk about that when we get to the Meet the Early Church Fathers. You know, welcome, and as always, you can be part of the discussion. Give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Or perhaps if you don't want to come on the air, but you would like to send a question, maybe there's been a question that a family member has asked you, not really sure how to answer it, or maybe somebody at work, or you've seen something on TV and you're not really sure whether, you know, that's just typical exaggeration that you see on these cable channels or not, shoot us an email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. That is the dojo mailbox, questions@handsonapologetics.com. And by the way, Hands On Apologetics is my home website, and I have a little section in there if you want to kind of get a preview of what's going to be happening this week on Hands On Apologetics. You just go to the HOA Live tab, and you can see that there. And also my other website, I probably should mention, is GaryMatuta.com. And that's where, that's really more where you can get all the different kinds of resources, CD sets, talks, books, all sorts of stuff at that website. And so just, you know, just FYI, I don't think I really mention these sites too often, so I probably should, just in case. And I know that a lot of people listen to this radio show on podcast, and we often go through things that have a lot of information that you just can't possibly get just by listening. And so many people want to listen again, maybe even write down notes. I've heard people do that too. As always, you can go to the virginmostpowerfulradio.org website. That is the place to go, virginmostpowerful.org. And you can get a podcast of Hands-On Apologetics, all the different episodes, and all the other programming that goes through this network. So it's a great one-stop place to come. It's avail yourselves of that resource, because that's, you know, when you're defending the faith, you need good resources, and there's great shows and other things on those websites. So it's time to give our shout out to those watching live stream at Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Good to see the familiar faces, or I should say familiar names, on the chat room there. yay, Sensei. All right. Yeah, Spanish Inquisition. Yeah, we're getting feedback from the live streams, so that's good. It's nice to know people are out there. Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. I can't wait to talk to Rob about the Inquisition. He actually has done quite a bit of research in that area, and it should be a lot of fun. So let's jump right into our exercises, shall we? First, the finding of the fallacy segment is the quantitative fallacy. And that's basically a fallacy that occurs when somebody makes a decision solely upon quantitative observations. In other words, all they care about is bean counting, numbers, metrics, statistics, hard data. And that's all they consider, okay, to the exclusion of everything else. That is the quantitative reasoning. And actually, this the quantitative fallacy actually has a nickname. It's known as the McNamara fallacy, and that's I don't know, probably a little bit of a pejorative, but it's aimed at Robert McNamara, who managed the Vietnam War, and he seemed to have obsessed over metrics and over counting and stuff in his management. And so he was more concerned about numbers rather than other less things that you can quantify, you know, other areas. Unfortunately, you know, this fallacy has been attributed to him, and he's kind of been the poster child of this. But basically, like I said, it's the fallacy when measurements are all that matter, and basically anything that can't be measured is minimalized or explained away or just treat it as if it doesn't exist. So we see this quantitative fallacy, especially with those who engage in scientism, that believe that only science is the only reliable knowledge we can have of the world, and things like that. All right, so that's our finding of the fallacy for today. And let's go to the Meet the Early Church Father, because, it's like I said, it's a strange early church father. The name is Ambrosiaster. In fact, you could say that the early church father is the Ambrosiaster. This particular person flourished sometime around 366 AD to 384 AD. Now, why do I say that's not his name? Well, basically, we have a commentary on the 13 Pauline epistles without Hebrews. And this group of commentaries, it was attributed in antiquity to St. Ambrose. And so it was kind of preserved along with his works. Well, you know, beginning with Erasmus in the 1500s, it was decided that due to the style and so on, that it wasn't actually an authentic work of Ambrose. And so Erasmus came up with the name Ambrosiaster, which means pseudo-Ambrose. Okay, so it's not a person's name. It actually just means it's someone who's attributed to Ambrose but isn't Ambrose himself. So this is an early church father that basically we don't know who it is. We don't have a name for this early church father. The work apparently originated in Rome sometime around the reign of Pope Damasus I, which is AD 366 to AD 384. And so we know the time period in which it was written. And part of the manuscript tradition attributes the commentary on Romans to a person named Hilary. But we don't know exactly who this Hilary is. It could be Hilary of Poitiers, who was another early church father. Maybe it's some other Hilary, right? There is other Hilaries we know in history. There's political figures and so on. So Ambrosiaster is an early church father which we have no real name. We don't really know who he is, so it's just known as by that name. Some people think it may have been a Jewish convert named Isaac who took the name Hillary. And later in his baptismal name was Gaudentius. Okay, so that's another possibility. Another thing, too, about Ambrosiaster is that not only does he do these commentaries, but part of these commentaries were also integrated in a work of St. Augustine, known as the 127 Questions on the Old and New Testaments. This is a pseudo-Augustine work, okay? So it's part of the works of Augustine, but there's some doubt as to whether it actually came from Augustine. So some of that came from this person who is known as Ambrosiaster. Okay, is everybody confused? Good. Then you understand the matter correctly. It's pretty confusing. But nevertheless, there are some very interesting things that are in this writing. For example, in his commentary in Romans 5:12, he talks about original sin, and he says that, quote, all have sinned in Adam, in mass as it were, for when he himself was corrupted by sin, all whom he begot was born under sin. On his account, then, all are sinners because we are all from him. He lost God's favor when he strayed, unquote. So that's from his comment on Romans. And, you know, there's all sorts of little goodies that I would love to quote. But unfortunately, you know, I can hear the music coming up faintly in the background. And so that means we're coming up to the commercial break. On the other side of the break, Master Apologist Robert Corzine is going to join us. And he's going to talk about the Spanish Inquisition. Don't want to miss it. Stay tuned, everybody.
If you're a listener to Virgin Most Powerful Radio, you already know about Hands-On Apologetics with Master Apologist Gary Machuda. And if you're a fan of Hands-On Apologetics, then we have some exciting news for you. This February, Sensei Gary will be leaving the Apologetics Dojo in Michigan to visit the Virgin Most Powerful Radio World Headquarters in Covina, California. And if you'll be in Southern California this February, we have more exciting news for you. Not only will Gary be doing his live show from our Virgin Most Powerful Radio studio, but he will be giving a live presentation on February 20th at 7 p.m. right here at the Sacred Heart Chapel. That's Gary Machuda speaking live on the topic of Breaking the Bible Barrier, Why Catholic Appeals to the Bible Fail, and How to Make Them Successful. For more information, call 877-526-2151 or visit virginmostpowerfulradio.org. It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. Yes. What is the one area of church history that has been used as a bludgeon to smack around Catholics. You know, what's a handy anti-Catholic historical stick to hit us with? Well, it is the Spanish Inquisition. Aha, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. And with us right now is my good friend Rob Corzine. He's the Vice President of Programs for St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. He was received into the Catholic Church in 1994, has held teaching and advocacy positions in several Catholic apostolates, including the work as an apologist and catechetical writer for Catholics United for the Faith, and as a producer and host of a weekly Catholic radio program on apologetics and evangelism. He is the host of EWTN's Genesis to Jesus with Dr. Scott Hahn, and he holds a degree in humanities and Catholic culture from the Franciscan University of Steubenville. Rob, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
It's good to be here, Gary.
Yes, you are the guest sensei at the Apologetics Dojo today, so we're expecting a lot. Well, hey, Rob, is it true that no one expects the Spanish Inquisition?
Well, it's true that no sane people expect the return of the Spanish Inquisition, but as Monty Python so cogently put it, our chief weapons are fear, surprise, ruthless efficiency, and almost fanatical devotion to the Pope, and most of that is completely untrue.
There is something true about that skit, though, is that the divergency between what the Spanish Inquisition was and what it's been made out to be, like, you know, it's the rack was the rack used for dishes, you know, and
that's right.
And the chair was the comfy chair. So it did have a kernel of truth.
Comfy chair.
That's right. It did have a kernel of truth.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Monty Python was actually closer to the truth than David Hunt, for example, who's probably the most extreme instance of a anti-Catholic clearly making up numbers out of the air. So he claimed that more than 3 million were condemned, with about 300,000 people burned at the stake. Generally speaking, you know, I mean, he's obviously not a historian. But generally speaking, when you read in history things that have, you know, nice round, you know, numbers with lots of zeros at the end, it's a sign that people are not telling the truth.
Let's talk about that.
That is only a few orders of magnitude larger than what some supposedly responsible historians, you know, have maintained. Because there was just there's not only a great deal of misinformation, but the, you know, especially in the English-speaking world, the anti-Catholic and anti-Spanish traditions of both England and Holland kind of fed into the kind of black legend of the Spanish Inquisition. So Edgar Allan Poe's The Pit and the Pendulum, and you know, Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. It's sort of it's a cultural trope that's really disconnected from the actual history of the Inquisition.
Yeah, it's the black legend. You know, what we understand today, you know, just in popular history, it was actually kind of a formulated propaganda piece by Protestant countries who broke off from the church and kind of used that as justification for hatred, you know, against especially Spanish Catholics.
Yeah, and it was politically advantageous for this sort of Spanish boogeyman, right? If we ever let Catholicism, if you ever give freedom to Catholicism in England, you know, this is the kind of thing that we'll have. We'll lose all of our English tradition of freedom, and we'll be subject to, you know, the lurking in the shadows, the all-powerful man who's trying to come to get you with his familiars and his prison keepers and his torturers, you know, and innocent victims being put to death and martyred for their faith. And that was kind of the, it was not just an anti-religious scare story, but it was also a way to maintain, those in power who were in England, of course, you know, keeping anybody who was a Catholic was not allowed to serve in the army or the navy or parliament or, you know, have official positions, be lawyers, be judges. So the penal laws were in part, you know, upheld as a necessary protection against the wicked boogeyman, you know, Catholics who are coming to get you, who were loyal to a foreign power, the Pope, and couldn't be good citizens.
Right, yeah. And also, England was at war with Spain, at least at one point.
Yeah, for part of it, you have both the Dutch who are subject politically to Spain and have a rebellion that takes not just political but religious terms, and then in the late 17th century, late 16th century, like 1588, right, you have the Spanish Armada. So there's some reality to the danger of Spain in invading.
Right, yeah. So what's interesting about the Black Legend to me is that we can actually kind of date where it happens. I mean, you could find the point of origin for all these crazy statistics and this idea of, all the craziness about the Black Legend. Like you said, it's omnipresent. No one can hide from the Inquisition. It's brutal. It's unjust. It's the hand puppet of the Pope. You know, those type of things. That doesn't really
right.
go back very far. You know, that's fairly recent.
No, in England, it's primarily a Protestant writer, you know, named John Fox, in his work Acts and Monuments, which is often translated and sold now. You can still find it in bookstores as Fox's Book of Martyrs.
That's right.
And so that has a profound impact on the English psyche. And during Elizabeth's reign, it was actually made mandatory for every parish in the kingdom to buy a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, to kind of undergird this this Protestant Anglican faith being imposed on the nation.
Right.
And then, of course, the Montanus is the other. So in the late 16th century, there's a work written in Latin, but quickly translated into lots of different languages. And in English, it was a discovery and plain declaration of sundry subtle practices of the Holy Inquisition of Spain. And since he was, a convert who had worked for the Inquisition before, it seemed to have a lot of legitimacy in people's eyes when he spoke. But again, while that had become the standard account and influenced, you know, even today, you know, some like encyclopedia entries and that sort of thing, it was wildly inaccurate, as modern historians can tell you. But it's really only in the 20th century that it passed over from this sort of area of propaganda into an area of serious historical research, and you know, historians and not necessarily Catholic historians, but just secular historians spent time in the archives, which after the Franco regime in the 20th century were open to scholars to dig in and actually document what had happened.
Yes, yeah. So that, in a sense, you know, this Black Legend, you know, it didn't pre-exist those particular authors, but it came in especially strong, like you said, in Holland and England, and then through the Enlightenment, it kind of morphs into, you know, this kind of religion as intolerance and shackling of the intellect and so on. But it's only recently that there's been some really groundbreaking research on the Inquisition that kind of has destroyed this whole Black Legend.
That's right. So now we have a really interesting and kind of unusual situation where there are a lot of like grossly inaccurate myths that are just common knowledge that everybody knows. So politicians make reference to it. Obviously, you know, Monty Python can mine it for the comedy value, and just because everyone knows. That happens at the same time that everyone doesn't include historians. So yes. Things that are just so grossly inaccurate that no professional historian would say them out loud are not even it's not just that people know less than historians, it's that the things that they think they know are absolutely the opposite of what historians, you know, now see as kind of commonplace, like common knowledge, not even debatable.
Right. And yeah, folks, this is very prevalent because my kid had a history book from high school just a couple of years ago, and in it the section on the Inquisition was horrible. It was all this myths and stuff and distortions, and you would think that, you know, well, high school, college textbooks, they would straighten it out, but actually, you know, in academia, like the people who actually are familiar with the material, they know that it's all bunk, but for some reason it just doesn't filter into the culture.
That's right. It's one of those things that people know, people feel like is so obvious that you wouldn't look up the facts. It's like everyone knows that the church was the enemy of religious liberty and of freedom of expression, and they still are. See, there are a lot of people even now, right, who are politically invested in that narrative, right? The progress of freedom and enlightenment and liberation is always opposed in that enlightenment and modernist and postmodernist narrative by obscurantists who are just stuck in tradition and don't have any case to make. No case can be made for them. They're just there to play that role in the story. And so the myth kind of proceeds without contradiction in a lot of quarters, even though nobody who actually looks at the data or reads the history of it can or is interested in defending it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Well, hey, when we come up on the other side of the break, because I'm starting to hear the music come up in my headphones, Rob, why don't we go through and kind of debunk some of the things that everybody knows is true about the Hispanic Inquisition? How's that sound?
Will do.
All right. So stay tuned, everybody. Listen to Hands-On Apologetics. And we are debunking the Black Legend of the Spanish Inquisition. Stay tuned.
If you're a listener to Virgin Most Powerful Radio, you already know about Hands-On Apologetics with Master Apologist Gary Machuda. And if you're a fan of Hands-On Apologetics, then we have some exciting news for you. This February, Sensei Gary will be leaving the Apologetics Dojo in Michigan to visit the Virgin Most Powerful Radio World Headquarters in Covina, California. And if you'll be in Southern California this February, we have more exciting news for you. Not only will Gary be doing his live show from our Virgin Most Powerful Radio studio, but he will be giving a live presentation on February 20th at 7 p.m. right here at the Sacred Heart Chapel. That's Gary Machuda speaking live on the topic of Breaking the Bible Barrier, Why Catholic Appeals to the Bible Fail, and How to Make Them Successful. For more information, call 877-526-2151 or visit virginmostpowerfulradio.org. It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. We are here with our guest, Robert Corzine. We're talking about the Spanish Inquisition. And Rob, before we even get into debunking the particulars, someone might say, well, what is it? Is it just guesswork, or are there actual records that people can pretty much know what was going on in the Spanish Inquisition?
Yeah, they kept very detailed records, and unlike, so like most courts, right, you have court reporting, you have very detailed records being kept, and unlike a lot of historical records where you have to wonder how sincere they are, because they're kind of making the case for themselves, one of the things that makes these records so reliable is that they never were intended to be made public information. This is your purely internal secret archives is literally what they were called. They weren't allowed to be shared. And for hundreds of years, that black legend continued and wasn't refuted for that very reason, is that these were considered sealed legal documents that no one could look in, even to refute obvious smears on the church. So it's only in the 20th century that people have dug into the actual case records, although the controlling documents were there all along. So the smear could have been answered and was answered by Catholic apologists, but secular historians have now looked not just at how it should have worked in theory, but at the actual case histories, the transcripts of the trials from in various places and across, a great deal of time. Because, of course, the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, operated for hundreds of years. So it's not the early Inquisition and the late Inquisition and the Inquisition in different parts of Spain and in the New World are all sort of very different creatures that we need to not sort of lump together as one thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably the first myth, is that there is no such thing as the Inquisition. Right. There are
right.
Inquisitions. Right. So, yeah. And, somebody might say, OK, well, why was it secret? From what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't a lot of these documents were essentially confessions. They were, they were a spiritual divulging of information that really was for the person's own protection and privacy, not so much trying to hide something.
That's right. So, Inquisition, it is now sort of a trope for an unjust legal proceeding, but it really is just a word that means investigation. And what they were investigating was the orthodoxy and the practice of Christians. So another myth is that this was directed against Jews and Muslims, and there's a kernel of truth there, but it is only... And legally, people who were not baptized were not subject to the Inquisition, because they can't be guilty of heresy. They can't violate their baptismal promises. So it only was addressed to Christians. And the first step was just getting a confession. If someone confessed their fault, they would be pardoned in sacramental confession. They'd be given a penance that was intended to match their error or their sin, and be sent on their way. And the vast majority of the people who were brought before the Inquisition had their case taken care of in exactly that way. They admitted a fault, And they did a penance, and the issue was closed. In the early, the most violent period of the Inquisition, it was actually very fairly common for people to come and denounce themselves, to kind of defend themselves from somebody else denouncing them. They would go and denounce themselves for some fault, have their faith examined by the inquisitors, and do a penance, but basically be kind of proclaimed an Orthodox Catholic, so as to defend themselves from the charges of their neighbors. And this would be mostly people who were either themselves converts from Judaism or Islam, or the descendants of those, where they'd be facing the suspicion of their neighbors. And one way to defend themselves from that suspicion was to go and get a sort of theological clean bill of health by denouncing yourself to the Inquisition.
Yeah, clear the air. Yeah, that's interesting. Let's talk death tolls, okay? That's probably the most distorted thing of all. You know, you can go on the web and find totals of those who were killed by the Inquisition, quote-unquote, that are so high it's practically the entire population of Europe at that time.
That's right.
They pulled that off. But let's talk about, first, did the Inquisition ever execute somebody?
Technically not. So the Inquisition was run by clerics, and clerics are not allowed to shed blood or to take life. Anyone who was going to be capitally punished would be capitally punished by the state. And that was because at the time, heresy, public, persistent, unrepentant heresy, was not just a sin, but also a crime by the state. And there was certain logic to it, right? That the society is based on the church and the state are not two completely separate things. The society is the company of the baptized, and somebody who steals your house or steals your livelihood steals something from you less valuable than somebody who steals the faith from you and puts you not just in danger of health or in danger of poverty, but in danger of eternal damnation. So it was the state, which at this time, so we're talking the late 15th century when it first begins in 1480. This is the exact time that the growth of the state is happening. And so Christendom is falling apart and being divided into a strong national state that separates and distinguishes itself from the church. And the Inquisition is actually part of the Spanish Inquisition, as opposed to the Roman or medieval Inquisitions, are part of that process. It's initiated by the crown, in this case the United Crowns of Aragon and Castile, and the inquisitors are appointed by the crown, and the punishments are meted out by the crown, so by the state in this case.
Yeah. Originally, though, wasn't it the Inquisition was meant to cap the power of the state, because the state had a vested interest in ensuring homogeny, ensuring peace in the land, and sometimes heretical groups could be seditious. They could be looking to overthrow the state, so the state could murder people based on whether or not they believed that they were part of heresy. So the church kind of stepped in and said, no, you don't have competence in that area. So it's a capping authority. But when you get to the Spanish Inquisition, then it's really more the state in control rather than the church.
That's right. This is an Inquisition that's requested by and run by and funded by the state. And so even when, after its first most violent period, where even in that period, the vast majority of the people are either completely exonerated or penanced. So they're in its most violent period, the death toll still amounts to a tiny a tiny, tiny percentage. And when the Jewish community, or the converso community, to be more precise, felt like they were not getting a fair shake, what they turned to was the Pope. So the people who were actually they felt like they were being unfairly persecuted, they didn't run, they didn't turn to rebellion, they didn't find another sort of secular leader. They knew where they could get relief, and they went to the Holy Father, who did intervene on their behalf, with some effect, though it was still really closely controlled by the crown. So you asked about numbers. We should look, at those really briefly. The first years are not as well documented, but everyone would agree that they're the sort of bloodiest days, and perhaps as many as 1,500 people might have been executed in that stage, or about 30 a year. And then turning to the fully recorded period, there were probably in full records of the 44,674 cases, you see about 1.8% of those brought to trial. So about 826 people were turned over to the state for execution. So during the entire period from 1480 through 1700, there were about 10 deaths per year by the Inquisition across all of Spain and the New World. So it's a tiny fraction of the number of people who were being executed in other countries at the same time for, in many cases, even much smaller crimes, or in the case of England, even Reformation England under Henry VIII, for their Lutheran or Lollard or Catholic faith, including his wives.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's one thing that's often missing with studies on Inquisition, is that it's singled out as if that was the only tribunal or a court of that type working in Europe, when actually there were all over the place. And when you compare the two, there's really no comparison. Actually, the Spanish Inquisition was very tame, wasn't it?
Yeah, not just in historical context. So when we look around as historians, we say, compared to all the other places at the time, Spain was actually pretty good. But even in Spain at the time, the people subject to it, the justice was better and the prisons were nicer. So you often find people accused of secular crimes committing ecclesiastical crimes like blasphemy in order to get transferred to an Inquisition prison.
If you're a listener to Virgin Most Powerful Radio, you already know about Hands-On Apologetics with Master Apologist Gary Machuda. And if you're a fan of Hands-On Apologetics, then we have some exciting news for you. This February, Sensei Gary will be leaving the Apologetics Dojo in Michigan to visit the Virgin Most Powerful Radio World Headquarters in Covina, California. And if you'll be in Southern California this February, we have more exciting news for you. Not only will Gary be doing his live show from our Virgin Most Powerful Radio studio, but he will be giving a live presentation on February 20th at 7 p.m., right here at the Sacred Heart Chapel. That's Gary Machuda speaking live on the topic of Breaking the Bible Barrier, Why Catholic Appeals to the Bible Fail, and How to Make Them Successful. For more information, call 877-526-2151 or visit virginmostpowerfulradio.org. It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matsuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
All right, thank you. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Master Apologist Rob Corzine from St. Paul's Center of Biblical Theology, talking about the Spanish Inquisition. And Rob, you know, my apologies because I brought you a little too close on the break, and you made a really important point. We were discussing, if you take what we know about the Spanish Inquisition and compare it to secular courts in Europe at that time, there is a great disparity. And you were saying about those who appeal in secular courts?
Yeah, that's right. So it's not just us looking and doing the comparative work and saying, wow, that was actually not the standard of justice we would like, but better than anything around it. It was also the people actually in that context. So not just from country to country, but if you were in Spain, we have a number of documented instances of somebody who had been taken up for a different crime by a secular magistrate wanting to get out of that jail and into a safer, more comfortable jail of the Spanish Inquisition, purposely committing an ecclesiastical crime like blasphemy so that they could change jurisdictions. They could get out of jail where they were and go to the Inquisition's jail and be adjudicated there. So that difference, again, not what we would want as a standard of justice, but for the time, the sort of gold standard of fairness and process and mercy. So the exact opposite of the image that we've inherited from the Black legend.
Yes, we have a caller, Nathaniel from Texas. Nathaniel, welcome to Hands on Apologetics. Nathaniel, are you there? Mr. Engineer? Nathaniel, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
All right. Hi, Nathaniel. Welcome. We're talking to Rob Corzine. Do you have a question?
Yes. Hi, Gary. Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. My question is about a statement that was made earlier about how the church didn't technically execute anybody. And my question is, like, how a judge doesn't execute a convict, the executioner does. Judge still signs the death warrant. When the church convicted these people of crimes of heresy and handed them to the state, didn't they know exactly what they were handing them over to? It's like saying, I didn't kill you, I just threw you to the wolves. Didn't the church throw thousands of people to the wolves and then say, oh, I didn't kill you?
Okay, well, thanks for your question. Rob, you want to take that? Rob, are you there?
Armed. The society considered that kind of heresy to be not just a sin, but a crime. And the person who could convict you of that crime through this means of investigation, you know, was definitely the Inquisition. So you're right that that's what I meant by saying this technically not the case. Although the control of the Inquisition and the Inquisitors by, especially in that first period, by the state rather than by the church, by the bishops who had that role previously, is a difference between the Spanish and medieval and Roman Inquisitions.
Yeah. You know, Nathaniel, that was kind of my comment, and the reason I brought it up was that sometimes you'll see depictions of the Inquisition where they actually have clerics burning people alive and things like that. And so it's a common misunderstanding. It was like that not only was it the trial, but also the executioner. So I just wanted to make that point that, in a sense, they stepped in before the state's execution. Does that help?
But this might actually be a good place to stick in, you know, another sort of aspect of the misunderstood violence, because the Gothic novels often depict really gruesome torture in the torture chambers of the Inquisition, whereas the law is perfectly clear in this case. Torture could be applied. It was a part of Roman law, and this period, you know, really following the 12th and the 13th century, you see the Romanization of the re-Romanization of European law. So they could apply torture, but that torture must be in the presence of multiple witnesses, including a physician, could not last for more than 15 minutes, could not endanger life or limb, and so it were, you know, that you, so you've got the rack, you have a basically waterboarding, so like not gentle stuff. And then also a torture where they basically twist your arm behind your back. And inheriting from Roman law the notion that confession is the gold standard, getting somebody to confess their crimes, you could apply torture under the rules of the Inquisition, but you couldn't redo it. You couldn't do it for extended periods of time. And anyone who confessed something under that pain had to then repeat it afterwards and confirm it. And so the inquisitors themselves were very skeptical of the use of torture, used it in a small minority of cases, and there was no shedding of blood involved, in the same way that they couldn't, under the law, execute anyone, they absolutely couldn't shed blood.
Okay. Yeah. Nathaniel?
So we know from modern day military training that even Navy SEALs can't survive or can't hold out to more than 60 seconds of waterboarding before they'll admit to anything to make it stop. And if you say, well, now that I've stopped waterboarding you, you have to say it again, or I'm going to waterboard you again, then of course they're going to say it again without being under duress.
No, couldn't be on the same day, and there couldn't be any repeat of the torture under the rules. I'm not saying we'd love those rules. I'm saying they weren't what you see in the Black Legend. So it was not, I'll stop if you say something. It was, you know, if anything you confess under pressure, you had to repeat and confirm after the pressure was applied. And again, because of those very reasons, even though it was there in Roman law, the inquisitors themselves, we know from their writings, were very skeptical of the value of confessions under duress.
Okay, right. So the church did sign death warrants, knowing that they would be sending people to their death?
The church certainly understood that capital crimes could be capitally punished, and that when they were certifying someone as an unrepentant or a repeat heretic, where it was a capital crime, that they would be capitally punished. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Nathaniel. We actually got to get moving on, but great questions. I appreciate you listening. Yeah, so you could only apply it once, and of course, if they recant it, you can't. Then, therefore, they can't use torture again to try to make them confess again, right?
That's right. You couldn't force someone into a confession and condemn them on that basis. It was it was a relic of the pagan Roman law that I think we have everywhere gotten away from, and wisely. It was seen as an interrogation technique, and that is not a result of their benighted medieval anti-freedom attitude, because you see it again pop up in 20th century America, that this is a useful interrogation tool. And I think we've sort of discovered again what the inquisitors knew themselves, that that it's not really a useful interrogation technique.
Yeah, in fact, near the end of the Inquisition, it wasn't used at all. It was kind of embarrassing, and they didn't want to use it anyway. But Rob, hey, we only have a minute or so. What's the implications? Will there ever be an Inquisition, and would it be a threat to religious liberty, or was it a threat to religious liberty?
Well, I think we have a different, but not a 100% different understanding of religious liberty now. So while you have in the Black Legend a mistaken notion of what it is, I think now some people have the opposite mistaken notion, that, you know, since Dignitatis Humanae in the Second Vatican Council, that we believe in religious liberty to mean that anyone can believe anything, and that's their right. You know, so people will sometimes talk about you have the right to be wrong, and we need to make a distinction, or the Church makes a distinction, that religious freedom is a civil right. So you have the right to investigate the truth for yourself. And when you do that, you should come to to true conclusions, but you have a right not to be coerced. So the Church addresses the world to convince, not to coerce. And the Church, absolutely repudiates, even if there were Christian states, the Church repudiates the use of coercive force, because it impedes the act of faith. The act of faith, by definition, is a free act. So as an individual, you don't have a right to just believe anything you want to. You have a moral obligation to seek out the truth and to be obedient to the truth when you know it. But you have a right to be free from people coercing you.
Very good. Okay, Rob, where can people get in touch with the good work you do at St. Paul Center?
You can get in touch with us at our website, stpaulcenter.com, and we have to do a lot of history work. But I would recommend, if you want more on this subject, there's a book called "Bearing False Witness: Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History," and Rodney Stark has a single chapter on the Inquisition. And if you want to read a larger book on the subject, the book by Henry Kamen, K-A-M-E-N, just called "The Spanish Inquisition." He's not a Catholic. He's a secular researcher who has established a lot of this in great detail for us.
Great, great book. Oh, thanks a lot, Rob. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, that's Rob Corzine. And, coming up tomorrow's program, we're going to answer the question, if there's one word of God, why are there so many translations? And Friday, Master Apologist Carlo Brassard joins us to talk about the existence of God. And coming up next, we have the dynamic duo of Catholic Talk Radio, the Terry and Jesse Show. So definitely want to stay tuned and listen to High Intensity Talk Radio. And I'm Gary Machuda. It's time here to turn off the lights at the dojo and close down the Midwest Command Center. It's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for listening to the program. And I'll see you tomorrow. God bless.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold. for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.